woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. A well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in the noose. Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. Crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, my reign. Used to care, but things have changed. Walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Someday the two hearts touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. Just don't show it. You can hurt someone and not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make that mistake. Some people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Thank you.
Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. It's Mike down here in Arizona land. Good morning. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 2nd of July, 2018. Okay. 2 July, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to the Liberty Tree Radio. We'll continue our block of instruction on the War of the Flea. Now we're going to start covering the part of about the political character of the Second Indochina War, the American role, the expansion of the war, and the outlook. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. My email address is altabeeb762@hotmail.com, altabeeb762@hotmail.com. As always, we send this broadcast out for Lily Grace Antoinette. A couple of things have gone on. Mexico had their election yesterday, and I guess Obrador got elected. Now, I've heard some things about his statements, but I'm not exactly sure of what it is. Something about open borders and all that usual everything. I guess there was also an arrest in New York City, something about the FBI and a terror plot for the 4th of July and somebody giving material support, and I don't know what all that's about. You know, we do know that the FBI has pretty good track record of creating terrorist organizations and groups so they can go in and bust them to make them look good. And they certainly aren't looking good. Every time they start shining up their tarnished badge, it seems like another Barney Fife comes along and really ruins it for everybody, whether it has to do with Ruby Ridge, Waco, numerous other deals, all these mentally retarded people that are supposedly terrorists that were funded and encouraged, trained by the FBI, and then they come in and bust them. And now all this stuff with these emails and Strzok and Page and Comey and et cetera, et cetera. So I just find it hard that now they're trying to improve their image, but for some reason they can't quite get there. So now they, oh, look, we saved you. If you would like to call in today, the telephone number is 712-432-0900. 712-432-0900. And a voice comes on to ask you what room you want, and that would be 957-464, and then the pound sign, and then you'll be here listening to your mind as your primary weapon. If you'd like to come up on the air, you can press star 6. And after you have your say, then you can press star 6 again, and then that'll mute you. So, 712-432-0900, and then 957-464, and the pound sign, and star 6 will both unmute and remute you. So let's see, the political character of the Second Indochina War and the American experience, the expansion of the war, and the outlook. Now, we all know what the eventual outcome was, but as a study on insurgency and the development, now, of course, we've also mentioned that there are some pretty knowledgeable people that pointed out that the Viet Cong, the Viet Minh, that really wouldn't qualify as an insurgency. It was a small, ruthless band that never really exceeded 1% of the population. So it really wouldn't qualify in our definition of insurgency as a people's uprising. But the silence that followed the fall of Dien Bien Phu is but a moment in the span of history, an all-too-brief breathing spell. Scarcely 5 years separate the first Indochina War, as Bernard Fall calls it, from the start of the second. And since then, events have made Vietnam again the focal point of global concern, the storm center around which swirls a vast political conflict, a clash of ideologies and empires that could easily produce a major war in Asia. Yet from a certain Vietnamese point of view, little seems to have changed in the essential situation. To the South Vietnamese peasants looking up from the rice paddies, the warplanes that whine overhead on their way to distant targets in the north, the helicopters clattering towards some battlefield rendezvous, are indistinguishable from the planes and helicopters that carried French troops in the battle against the Viet Minh a decade ago. Now, to the communist guerrilla in the bush or in the villages, today's battle is like that of yesterday and last year and the year before that. The war is all of a piece, and many young men cannot remember when there was no war. Oh, the French and the Americans had different uniforms, but that was in Saigon. But the directives come from Washington instead of Paris. The Viet Minh are now called the Viet Cong, and the new invaders, for a long while given the courtesy title of military advisors, but now finally acknowledged to be combatants, are called Americans. It makes little difference, French or American, Viet Minh or Viet Cong, the war goes on. Both sides pursuing the same objectives as before, and by the same familiar methods. Now, it is a struggle of dog and flea. The flea continues slowly but inevitably to multiply and to win. Now, a United Press International news analysis of 24 March 1965, disclosing in a few telling paragraphs the dilemma of the American forces in Vietnam. And it could almost have been written a decade earlier with respect to the French situation of that time. Quote, "The United States is now deep into the fourth year of an increasingly bloody battle for this land of mountains, jungles, rice paddies, and communist guerrillas. Since May of 61, when the United States first committed itself to support the anti-communist Saigon government, it has poured in vast quantities of men and machines, from rifles to rockets, from jeeps to tanks, from helicopters to jet bombers. The United States has moved in billions of dollars worth of the most sophisticated weapons in its arsenal. It has given freely of its brains, its blood, and its lives. All have been to no avail. The world's mightiest nation has been unable to find the key to success in Southeast Asia. From the day it set foot in this unhappy land, the United States' course in the fight against communism has been downhill. When the war in South Vietnam began, the rebels operated in no more than platoon strength. They were able to ambush a truck here or knock over an isolated outpost there. But as they accumulated American weapons from the bodies of the government dead, they replaced their homemade firearms and recruited young men to make their platoons into companies. The Viet Cong claimed to have liberated more than three-quarters of the total territory of the nation and to have established schools, hospitals, and public works. The Viet Cong have designated the cities as the last stronghold of the Saigon regime and its American masters. And the fact is that the American troops do spend much of their time in the relative safety of urban areas. They are ferried out in helicopters. When they take to the roads, it is in armored cars and tanks. Still, they are ambushed. And using the communist technique of two steps forward, one step back, the Viet Cong practices a flexibility in tactics that the government has never been able to achieve. And that was Arthur J. Domen, D-O-M-M-E-N, called The Great Decision, 1965, in the United Press International Series. Now, by all signs, it's a desperate military situation, far more desperate than that of the French during the siege of Dien Bien Phu. It goes far to explain the desperation of Washington's responses, beginning with air raids on supposed Viet Cong supply lines in the north, and rapidly escalating by the spring of 1965 to a sustained aerial offensive against a wide variety of targets of opportunity deep in North Vietnam. And as late as March 25, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson took occasion to declare, quote, "The United States still seeks no wider war. We threaten no regime and covet no territory. We have worked and will continue to work for a reduction of tension on the great stage of the world," end quote. But both Hanoi and Peking clearly felt threatened by the American military buildup and the continued air offensive. And nor was the anxiety theirs alone. The French President de Gaulle had long been pressing for a negotiated settlement of the war. And in London, March 23, Prime Minister Harold Wilson said that Britain would ask an explanation of a statement attributed to U.S. Ambassador Maxwell Taylor in Saigon, to the effect that the United States would, if need be, wage war without limit in Vietnam. Now, Johnson's declaration of peaceful intentions failed to reassure a worried world, and the president asserted that the United States sought no wider war, but added in the same breath, "This is no struggle of white men against Asians. It is aggression by communist totalitarians against their independent neighbors. The aggression from the North must be stopped. That is the road to peace in Southeast Asia." Now, the implicit denial of the existence of a civil war in South Vietnam, a territory already three-quarters in the hands of the Viet Cong guerrillas, the insistence on blaming communist totalitarians, aggression from the North, with clear reference to North Vietnam and China, suggested an obvious, ominous conclusion. The United States, unable to win in South Vietnam, seemed all too clearly to be preparing to expand the struggle into a broader arena in which American technology superiority would count for more, a Korean War situation in which the American public would perforce support a new full-scale crusade against communism in the Orient. The ostensible objective of the air offensive against North Vietnam was to free Hanoi, perhaps also Peking, to negotiate a settlement, a return, as Johnson put it, to the essentials of the agreement of 1954. A reliable argument to guarantee the independence and security of all in Southeast Asia. But since Hanoi and Peking, even if supporting the Viet Cong, were scarcely in a position to dictate terms to guerrillas on the brink of victory in South Vietnam, talk negotiations would hardly be taken seriously. Now, the situation confronting the Pentagon in March of 65 was well summarized by the Washington columnist Marcus Childs on March 25, 1965. The headlines from day to day concentrate on American bombing of North Vietnam. They divert attention from the grim fact fundamentally to the conflict and American involvement. The war on the ground in South Vietnam is rapidly being lost. So far reaching is the control of the Viet Cong guerrillas that it has become all but impossible to supply outlying provinces except by transport planes. Increasingly, by the United States bombing in South Vietnam and the use of napalm, the Vietnamese people in the South are being alienated. It is becoming more and more certain that American ground troops in division strength will have to be committed to Vietnam if the war is not to end in a disastrous defeat. Now, on the eve of his visit to Washington to report to President Johnson, Ambassador Maxwell Taylor said almost as much. The point of no return on the road to full-scale direct military commitment to carry on the war on the ground and in the air seems, therefore, to be at hand. So we have to ask, how did this situation develop and why? And in order to consider the conflict in Vietnam with any degree of certainty, it's necessary for Americans to digest some unpalatable facts. Unpalatable because we are accustomed to think of ourselves as Democrats, anti-colonialists, libertarians, not as imperialists, and never as aggressors. But the painful fact is that, from the Vietnamese point of view, the Second Indochina War is a direct continuation of the first. Politically, it continues to be a struggle for territorial independence and freedom from foreign, or at any rate, Western domination. As socially, it continues to be a socialist, i.e. Marxist revolution, aimed at destroying an economic system that is compatible with our own and replacing it with one that, as it happens, is not. Now, in the effort to block the process, the United States assumed the position of the French colonial power in South Vietnam and adopted similar methods in pursuit of parallel goals. Now, history is unlikely to make the fine distinction between French communalist and American anti-communist. Now, the distinction between French soldiers and American military advisors will constantly be lost. But what remains clear is that where the French sought to retain Vietnam as a colony, part of their once vast sphere of influence, the United States seeks to secure it as a satellite, that is, as part of an Asian domain that we deem essential to American interest, responsive to us economically, politically, and above all, militarily. So this is to describe events in a single area of a worldwide power struggle. A World War II destroyed the old spheres of influence and the old balance of power. The First Indochina War was a part of that disintegration. And the realignment is now in progress with the so-called Third World, the underdeveloped world of former colonies, as the field of combat and object of contention. Now, what does not come into the American orbit will fall, so we fear, into the communist, Chinese, or Russian orbits. And hence, our concern with South Vietnam and our assumption of the French role in that country. Now, the strikes in Southeast Asia are large, asserted the New York Times on May 24, 1964. If Laos and South Vietnam should fall to the communists, they would likely take with them Cambodia, Thailand, and Burma, possibly even Malaysia and the Philippines, close to 115 million people. And the loss of South Vietnam, said former President Eisenhower, would mean a tremendous loss of prestige, the loss of the whole subcontinent of Southeast Asia. Now, Joseph Alsop wrote, if defeat in South Vietnam is passively accepted, all admit that this defeat will be the worst and most costly that the U.S. has submitted to in this century. And from life magazine on 12 June 1964, abandoning Southeast Asia would be a disaster. The communist forces would take over. The U.S. would have demonstrated that it lacks the skill to win a guerrilla war and the guts to back its promises to its allies. The U.S. military lines would retreat to Okinawa, Japan, and the Philippines would be endangered, and Indonesia would be out of control, and the U.S. influence in Asia as a practical manner would come to an end. Now, those views were endorsed in official Washington, as Secretary of Defense Robert Strange McNamara said in a policy statement, "The survival of an independent," read U.S.-oriented, "government in South Vietnam is so important to the security of Southeast Asia and to the free world that I can conceive of no alternative other than to take all measures within our capability to prevent a communist victory." The late President Kennedy termed Southeast Asia vital to the United States as a Pacific power, and as early as June of 64, President Johnson had declared that the United States would risk war, meaning with China, in defense of the area. And the American commitment continued to widen and deepen. And by May of 65, some 45,000 Americans were serving in the Vietnamese theater, as compared with just 685 in 1959. And direct military and economic aid to the Saigon government had risen by the end of the year to $700 million annually, with a total commitment of $5.5 billion since 1954. But the war goes on, with the Americans in the role once occupied by the French. There are, however, vital differences. Most of them work to the advantage of the communists. Washington's political and psychological inability to call a spade put the United States in the awkward position for fighting what is still essentially a colonial war. Instead of a direct chain of command, there was an unreliable native government, or series of governments, in Saigon, and a Vietnamese general staff to which the American military staff stood in relationship of advisor. But where the burden of the war formerly was carried by the troops of the intervening foreign power, the French Foreign Legion, North Africans, and so on, mainly foreigners who stood above Vietnamese politics, it is now to be left to some 400,000 native troops, Vietnamese who, like the rest of the population of their country, had minds of their own and did not necessarily view the war in the same light or even with the same objectives as the Americans. But the French were not engaged in a popularity contest in North Vietnam. They were military men and frank colonialists, confident of their patriotic mission. Their war was military, and they had little fear of losing it in the field. But the departure of the French and the assumption of their role by the Americans marked an important political transition. The Saigon government, which clearly an instrument of American policy and a military dictatorship in the bargain, was not in the comparatively independent position of a foreign military government commanding an army of occupation. It was compelled to take account of public opinion, to retain the confidence not only of its banker, the United States, but also of that sector of the Vietnamese populace that supported or tolerated it, including the large, burdensome army and its intrigue-ridden officers' corps. Now, the inability of such puppet regimes in a guerrilla war situation is revealed by the record of no fewer than 9 successive governments, starting with Ngo Dinh Diem's regime, have been overthrown since 63, and the 10th is no stronger than its predecessor. But in fostering the pretense that the Saigon authorities at the moment constituted an independent government, of which the United States was merely an ally, hopefully supplying the means to resist aggression from the north, Washington suffered a serious loss of control and was exposed to political pressure from which the French, through hag-ridden by their own domestic political problems, had been relatively immune. Now, I see we're down at the bottom of today's broadcast. I expect to hear the music coming in here. And when we get back, we'll talk about the $5.5 billion of aid to South Vietnam, 18,000 American visors, and joining together with the band. We'll be right back. Thanks for taking the time to listen to Liberty Tree Radio. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. 2 July 2018, it's a Monday, and your mind is your primary weapon. Part of what today's lesson goes to is the plain and simple fact that you cannot fight a low-intensity conflict with mid-intensity tactics. The insurgents have the upper hand, and you can't kill your way out of an insurgency. Let's see. We'll continue our lesson about the military reverses and unpopular draft, religious rivalries, riots. But your mind is your primary weapon. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today to Liberty Tree Radio, and thank you for helping keep the broadcast on the air. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. We've talked numerous times about Bob Miner. If you'd like to call and leave a few words of encouragement, his telephone is 701-251-2365, 701-251-2365. Voice will come on asking you if you want to purchase a phone card or talk to him directly, and then it'll ask you to enter in the first three digits of his last name, MIN646, and then it says leave a message after the tone, and you'll have about 10 seconds or so. Not very long to leave words of encouragement. If you'd like to help Bob out, sending him maybe, say, you find an interesting news article, print it off, and you can send it to Bob Miner, or Robert Miner, SCCC, 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. Robert Miner, M-I-N-E-R, and the four letters, it would be Sierra Charlie Charlie Charlie, 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. As always, we send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette. And as I mentioned earlier, they had their election in Mexico yesterday, and they elected a new president, Obrador. And there was also a news item this morning, late breaking news, an arrest in New York City, breaking up a 4th of July terrorist plot. I don't know what that's going to be. I don't really put a lot of faith and hope and trust in the Fraternal Brotherhood of Incineration and their long track record of heavy-handedness. If you'd like to join today's broadcast, telephone is 712-432-0900. The voice will come on asking for the room, and that would be 957-464, and then the pound sign. And then you can enter *6 to unmute your phone. And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. But back to the military reverses, an unpopular draft, religious rivalries, student riots, the intrigue of ambitious generals, war wariness, and any number of the complicated factors could tip the delicate political balance and leave the Pentagon with a war to conduct and no representation in Saigon, and that is, no one to do the fighting. Small wonder if the military men on the Potomac fervently wish to expand the war to bring their own reliable forces into it full war strength. And so the military reasoning would go to regain control of it, free at last from the sticky ooze of Oriental politics. But whatever the ultimate decision with regard to the massive American intervention, it was amply clear by the end of 64 that the war against the guerrillas in South Vietnam could not be won by the means heretofore pursued. The might very well easily be lost. Now, the course of the insurgency in South Vietnam, having little to do with Hanoi until it had reached its critical phase, and even less to do with Peking, except in an ideological way, has followed the classic pattern of the First Indochina War. Isolated acts of terrorism and sporadic attacks on remote military or police posts, beginning as early as 1955, could not have been controlled except by calling out the army in full force. Yet the Diem regime could not make such a response without confessing that all was not well with the country, and did not find it politically expedient to make the admission. Instead, Diem played ostrich, pretending that the bandits were under control and hoping that the national police would soon justify the pretense. Now, by the time the magnitude of the Viet Cong threat was realized, the guerrillas had already gained formidable strength and were fully competent to cope with the Vietnamese army, even backed by American arms, aircraft, and advisors. Progressive increases in the amount of United States military and economic aid to Saigon government at all times lagged far behind the needs of the actual situation. And by mid-1964, attacks in platoon strength had given away to organized assaults in battalion or even regimental strength, and the Viet Cong had grown from a few scattered guerrilla bands to an army of more than 140,000, counting both Chu Luk regulars and auxiliaries. Now, Neil Sheehan of the United Press International reported on April 27, 1964, from a few scattered bands backed by a fairly extensive secret political organization, the communist Viet Cong have built a formidable fighting force of 40,000 men. They are organized into 45 battalions throughout the country, and they are supported by well over 100,000 less well-armed, but still effective local and regional guerrillas. Strong rear base areas have been established, and the Saigon government has been virtually isolated from the rural population, so comprising 85% of a nation of nearly 16 million people spread over a land area of some 127,000 square miles. Now, outside of the big centers of population, the guerrillas were virtually unchallenged in much of the country, unmolested except by aircraft and occasionally by big helicopter-borne expeditionary forces stabbing in the dark, seeking needles in a haystack. Government armored columns were able to enter Viet Cong areas, but not without danger of ambush, and not with any hope of remaining or exercising authority over the people. Most of the major arteries and almost all of the secondary roads have been cut. Some provincial capitals were accessible only by air, and a ring of insurgent bases around Saigon created an atmosphere of siege even in the capital, with battles sometimes mounted within 6 or 8 miles of the city. And the Viet Cong maintain a viable rural economy in its own areas. The Viet Cong tax collectors gathered important revenues from the commerce still continuing between the insurgent zones and the cities, to such an extent that in some cases even the gasoline used to transport government troops to battle had already been taxed by the communists while on its way to the barracks. American economic aid to Saigon, exclusive of military aid, was put at some $241 million annually. And its objective, to improve the agricultural economy and to win the support of the rural population. But the director of operations of the Agency for International Development, AID, James Killen, estimated that 10 to 15% of the total went to twilight areas that might be government controlled one day and in the hands of the Viet Cong the next. Now, on August 15 of 1964, the New York Times reported, control over an area can change overnight. In many parts of the country, American field workers complete a technical aid project, a bridge, road, or well, only to have the guerrillas occupy the village the moment the Americans and their Vietnamese co-workers pull out. So what had happened in South Vietnam recalled the experiences of China and in other hemispheres, or Cuba. The insurgents had established a competing economic and political system, dividing the national territory, and although the army might still go where it chose, but always in strong force, because it could not remain without spreading itself too thin to resist concentrated guerrilla attacks. Thus, the troops were increasingly restricted to their garrisons in the larger towns and cities and increasingly made impotent. So the clear and hold operations, patterned on the French oil slick technique, failed to remedy the situation for the obvious reasons. Now, this clear and hold strategy is always doomed to failure because the government, while strong enough to clear any given area temporarily, cannot hold many such areas without dangerously scattering its forces. And in the face of a determined clear and hold drive, the guerrillas simply withdraw and redouble their activities elsewhere. And considering that the South Vietnamese Army, if even dispersed over the national territory, could have about 3 armed men to each square mile, it is easy to see why clear and hold could not succeed against the Viet Cong's 140,000 strong and supported by virtually the entire rural population. Now, here Saigon and its American military advisors encountered the French dilemma so well grasped by Giap. If they scattered their forces, they became too weak to defend themselves, and if their manpower was destroyed piecemeal. Yet if they concentrated their strength, they surrendered the territory which it was their purpose to occupy, for victory could mean nothing if not the occupation of the national territory. More than 3,000 government troops today slogged through flooded rice paddies in a suspected communist stronghold 35 miles northwest of Saigon in one of the biggest and most fruitless operations of the Vietnam War. The one read the troops located wounded in a Vietnamese soldier with a shotgun had escaped. The news item reflected a typical situation, as in most insurgencies. The guerrillas were able to choose their targets and to accept or reject combat at will. The government, lacking the military intelligence that popular support provides, found itself groping in the dark, engaged in random hit-or-miss operations that were inordinately expensive for the results achieved. A news dispatch of April 21, 1964, provides more evidence of the same weakness. One group of today's government statistics indicates that frustration of this war. Government small unit operations such as search or probes by patrols reached a peak of 5,190 during the week. The spokesman said no more than 70 of those actually had made contact. Contact, let it be pointed out, does not necessarily imply any further success. And as we've already noted, the Saigon government put itself under a severe handicap and gave its opposition a long head start by refusing to admit, for some years, the significant armed opposition existed in South Vietnam. isolated clashes with guerrillas were dismissed as the activities of a negligible remnant of Viet Minh diehards still in the country. And it was not until 5 years later that the No regime was finally forced to concede the by then undeniable fact that a full-grown insurgency was in progress. The Viet Cong, meanwhile, had been building a powerful underground political apparatus and organizing guerrilla units on village and regional levels for the struggle to come. And the early strategy of the movement was aimed at breaking the chain of political command from Saigon to the rural areas, isolating the government from the population of some 17,000 hamlets and 8,000 villages by subverting, kidnapping, or assassinating local officials, in particular village chiefs and members of village councils. Now, the campaign was begun in 1957, where more than 700 officials were killed, and was sharply stepped up in 1959, continuing through 1963, despite government efforts to halt it, and accounting altogether for an estimated 13,000 lives. We've covered this part before in our basic presentation of insurgency and the proper application of terrorism, removing the impediments to the movement. It's interesting here that a lot of the principles that we discuss about the rear base areas, recoup, retrain, recruit, rest, rearmament, where these take place, and oftentimes the government feels obligated to go after those base areas that are in inaccessible areas, and then the proper use of the guerrillas of that they have the upper hand. The insurgents always have the upper hand because they get to choose the time and the place. And it is said many times, if you try to guard everywhere, you guard nowhere. But with the political liaison between the capital and the villages effectively broken, the guerrillas began to build their army. And despite the political statements about aid from aggressors in the north, the simple fact is that probably 90% of the Viet Cong arms consist of American weapons captured from the government troops. Now, Saigon's own statistics acknowledge that the Viet Cong captured 4,853 weapons during 1960, while losing only 920 weapons in action, for a net gain of 3,932, sufficient to arm a regiment. In 62, the insurgents captured 52,000 weapons and lost 4,850. And in 1963, the gain was 83,000. The loss only 5,400, and the totals represent a net gain for the Viet Cong over a two-year period of 128,000 weapons of all types, a number almost equal to the total of insurgents in all of South Vietnam. Now, according to the Associated Press, quoted by I.F. Stone biweekly of May 13, 1963. Question, how does the Viet Cong get its weapons? Answer, most Viet Cong weapons are new U.S. military weapons captured in ambushes on government units and attacks on outposts. Often a Viet Cong unit is organized initially with no weapons, and the political organizer tells his men and women they must fight at first with handmade arms, spears, daggers, swords, and crude shotguns to get better weapons. The unit must capture them from the enemy. The system evidently works. Viet Cong arms are now include modern recoilless cannons, heavy mortars, good machine guns, and very large supplies of submachine guns. Now, most of the Viet Cong arms were seized in small unit engagements. The government casualty, too, mounted as a result of many, many such small scattered attacks, launched wherever superior position and superior numbers gave the Viet Cong assurances of easy victories. And the insurgent operations in battalion force were rare until late in 1963, and it was not until well into 1964 that the Viet Cong began to engage in isolated set piece battles of a conventional sort, on occasion abandoning guerrilla tactics for local tests of strength. Now, the change of tactics, while not yet a consistent pattern, was an important indicator, serving notice that the war was slipping into a new phase from the period of the strategic defense, so-called, to the stage in which an equilibrium of forces is reached and the government loses the military initiative to the insurgents. And throughout 1964, the Viet Cong showed it increasingly capable of standing and fighting on occasion when it demanded it, and with results often disastrous to the government forces. Casualty figures disclosed today showed that the South Vietnamese government suffered its worst losses last week in the war against the communist guerrillas. A spokesman for the United States Military Advisory Command said that casualties among Saigon's forces in the week starting April 12 totaled 1,000. The total consisted of 200 killed in action, 600 wounded, and 140 captured or missing in action. And during the week, 26 American casualties reported, including one death in action. The week included a five-day operation in the southern Mekong Delta near the post of Kien Long, and that operation produced some of the fiercest, most prolonged fighting of the war, the five-day battle, which started with a Viet Cong attack on Kien Long. And that was declared officially ended Thursday afternoon when the government forces finally lost contact with the guerrillas. That was from the New York Times, April 22, 1964. Now, the communist guerrilla attacked five government outposts and sank a landing craft in the weekend action near the Cambodian border, leaving as many as 46 South Vietnamese soldiers dead or missing, it was announced. And the Viet Cong also captured large supplies of government arms and ammunition, United Press International, 18 May of 1964. A massive airborne assault Wednesday against a Viet Cong jungle stronghold 40 miles northwest of Saigon found a base evacuated. The Viet Cong, with their shadow government reaching into cities and villages throughout most of South Vietnam, had apparently once again been forewarned. At the weekend, the offensive was continuing with the sweep of the general area by 7,000 Vietnamese troops. Only light contact was reported, however, and the whole operation was sharpening doubts within the U.S. Advisory Command about the efficiency of large-scale assaults against an elusive enemy. The New York Times, 22 November, 1964. In a lightning pre-dawn strike, communist Viet Cong guerrillas swarmed from the mountain jungles northwest of Saigon yesterday and overran a major district capital. In Washington, President Johnson ordered urgent consultations with the Saigon government to improve in all aspects the war against the Viet Cong, United Press International, 2 December, 1964. Now, the scale of the fighting through 64 indicated that the communists were rapidly gaining the military initiative. When the United States military buildup began in South Vietnam in November of 61, reported United Press International, the situation had been considered critical because the Viet Cong had become strong enough to initiate no fewer than 1,782 attacks and small-scale incidents in that month. But in November of 63, after 2 years of massive American military and economic aid, the number of Viet Cong attacks and incidents jumped to 3,182 for the month. And the continuing buildup was reported in December to have doubled the size of the South Vietnamese Air Force, but the results were by no means in ratio to the increase in striking power. And that was reported in the New York Times of December 3. When we get back next week, because I see we're right up to the top right now, we'll continue this. And these are important lessons on both the insurgent side and the government security forces fighting the insurgents, that the insurgents have the upper hand because they can choose the time and the place, and the government usually feels obligated to chase the insurgents, to strike them in their rear areas. And oftentimes, when the guerrillas set up a guerrilla camp, that there is no problem with it being evacuated in less than an hour. And oftentimes that the government may find out where these camps are located. By the time they get there, the guerrillas have already left. They've dispersed out into the hinterland, into the countryside. And there's just brief skirmishes, just a delaying tactic, shoot a couple of rounds and retreat, fall back and regroup. And then the government expends massive amounts of artillery and ammunition, manpower, and gasoline, time. Just back to that same lesson with Mao Zedong, time, space, and will. We're going to surrender space to buy time to build the people's will to resist. And in a roundabout way, I see that very same thing happening here in the United States. Now, oftentimes I try to spell things out that it's unfortunate that the communists are well-funded and well-organized. And oftentimes I hear people talking about how calling them snowflakes, undesirables, and kooks, and children. But it certainly appears to me that they're fairly well organized. But, of course, it seems to be that, for the most part, the patriot movement in the United States resembles a bunch of squabbling school children on the playground, and nobody wants to work together, and all it is whisper campaigns and playing the will of the people, of the communists, the Marxist ideology of divide and conquer and splintering of the groups, things. You have to have the unity of command. And I understand the part of about that aspect, but this whole, how should we say, there is going to come a time when there is a requirement of a unity of effort, and this whole leaderless resistance realized that it doesn't work. Well, we got the end of the broadcast coming up. Hear the music coming in. Well, that was another fun-filled, information-packed broadcast here on Liberty Tree Radio, and I'm asking if you people out there can really help keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. Your mind is your primary weapon. This is Mike in Arizona land saying sayonara, and as always, we send this broadcast out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. Thank you for your time. I'll see you on Thursday over on the Micro Effect. Any minute now, I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Should be in Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks
Putting it on.